I want you to see this if we can, Caleb. Get it back. This is the very first plane that I purchased for the Lord back in December 1994. And I said, where I began. And then the second one I purchased was in January 2004, where I used to be. The one I'm flying right now, and it's been with me 12 years, I purchased it in January 2006, where I am. So think about this. This was paid cash. This was paid cash. This was paid cash. And the new one's going to be paid cash also. Now, let me make this announcement so everybody can understand this. I don't own the plane. This belongs to the ministry. If Jesus tarries and I go by the way of the grave, the next person that's going to take this ministry will use that, just like we use all the different things that are happening in our ministry today. I really believe that if Jesus was physically on the earth today, he wouldn't be riding a donkey. Think about that for a minute. He'd be in an airplane preaching the gospel all over the world.
Hello?
Podcast of verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Bowman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
From the Pac Northwest studio of the Podcast 99 Network. Located in beautiful downtown Silverdale, Washington. This is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show podcast. Now, here is your host, the submarine qualified, well-coffeed, rules-driven, elitist history buff, Dave Bowman.
Weapons con, you have permission to fire.
I have permission to fire, con, weapons on.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in the city of Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States. Over the next 4 months, they would debate, discuss, argue, and refine the first document of its kind in all of history, an attempt to show that men can rule themselves by law. This is the story of those men and those times. This is Constitution Thursday, a time we set aside to read, discuss, study, debate, and learn about the Constitution of the United States, what it meant when it was written, why it was written that way, what it means now, and how it affects our lives each and every day. Here's how you can participate. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. And on the web and social media, just search for Constitution Thursday.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Well, Congress won't, but maybe the Department of Labor can? Who knows? We look at free exercise of religion on Constitution Thursday. So, from time immemorial in this country, so it's really not immemorial at all, it goes back to the founding of the government, the country, 1787. The questions about what does it mean to freely practice my religion have been perhaps the most vexing of all. I mean, you can get into freedom of speech and you can say, well, can he really say that? Can he not say that? All those questions are problematic. But when it comes to religion, because as Thomas Jefferson, the great founding father, not framing father, but founding father, once remarked, religion's between God and man. That's between you and God, right? So if you believe that God would be flying an airplane as opposed to riding a donkey, well, that's kind of between you and him, isn't it? It's intriguing to me because, of course, I have my own religious faith, for which, quite frankly, I've been roundly criticized at times. I have people that I grew up with that won't talk to me anymore because of my religious beliefs. But I also firmly believe that my religious beliefs are not for you, and yours are not for me, and so it's a waste of time for you to try to convince me otherwise or for me to try to convince you otherwise. It's between me and God. It's between you and God. I don't need to tell you. I don't need to preach to you, and you don't need to preach to me, basically, because all you're really going to do is piss me off. And as I said yesterday, one of the things that irks me greatly are politicians who insist on inflicting their religious beliefs on people. That just frosts me. And I'm not the only one that had that concern. 200 and some odd years ago, the Baptist Church in Danbury, Connecticut, had the same concerns. They were very worried about the ability to worship freely in these new United States of America. They were very happy that Thomas Jefferson had been elected president of the United States. There were some reasons for that. The previous administration had been, shall we say, less than friendly to the ideas of the Constitution. Remember, the Federalists passed the Alien Sedition Act, the first version of that. They started putting people in jail for criticizing the government. Well, that seemed to be a pretty clear violation of the First Amendment, but then they packed the courts and upheld that. So if speech can go away, religion is probably next, was kind of their attitude. They were thrilled when Jefferson was elected to the presidency of the United States because he was well known as a fighter for religious freedom. Now, we could spend a lot of time, and I'm not going to, on what did Jefferson believe. Was he a Christian? Was he a deist? Was he an atheist? Who cares? He worked very hard to pass the Religious Freedom Act in Virginia over Patrick Henry's objections, and he made it clear. He says one of my favorite things, which, what difference does it make if my neighbor believes in one God or 20? It doesn't affect me. It doesn't matter to me. It doesn't change anything in my life. As long as the actions that this man takes don't impede my rights, why do I care? And in the modern era, I've kind of adapted that philosophy. What do I care if my next door neighbor dresses like a girl? If he's a guy and he dresses like a girl, what do I care? As long as he's not requiring me to believe something or do something that violates my own conscience and my own religion, what difference does it make? The Danbury Baptists were ecstatic, and they wrote a very short. One of the things I regret, if I can get a little off topic here, writing today sucks compared to what it was back then. I got in a conversation the other day about what do you say to people who on Memorial Day walk up to veterans and say thank you for your service, and there was a whole bunch of, you know, back and forth about yell at them for being wrong about this and take it gracefully for this and that. Jefferson got this letter from the Danburys, and this is what he said about what half the letter is them singing his praises. Okay, I could read it to you, but I don't want to take the time right now. But here's his response. The affectionate sentiment of esteem and approbation which you are so good as to express towards me on behalf of the Danbury Baptist Association give me the highest satisfaction. The writing of that era was so much better than it is today. I think I'm going to adapt that. When somebody compliments me in the future, I'm just going to say that. The approbation you give me brings me the highest satisfaction. I'm no longer going to just say thank you. I don't know. It just seemed like the kind of thing to say. The letter that Jefferson wrote back to the Baptists has become famous. Of course, it's the Danbury letter, and it's most famous for its suggestion, which, again, is not found in the Constitution, it's not found in law, of the separation of church and state. And like most things, the letter is oversimplified into just that. Jefferson favored the separation of the church and state, never the twain shall mix, and we've gone forward from that era, 216 years ago, with this idea that the separation of church and state, which we hold dear, many of us hold dear, particularly those of us who belong to religious minorities, hold very dear, as an absolute within the constitutionality of the United States. But is it? And when you start getting into this free exercise thereof thing, boy, does that open a can of worms, doesn't it? Just think about the arguments in the history of our country that it would involve the free exercise of religion. You have Native American religions where drug use, peyote, is part of the religion. You have certain faiths that can only eat certain things. Well, what happens when somebody of that faith is confined and are incarcerated? Can you force them to eat something else? The list goes on and on, but there are a couple of major ones that we'll well, at least one major one that we're going to get into as we talk about this. Jump forward from Danbury about 212 years. The year is 2014. And in Akron, Ohio, the Grace Cathedral Church. Now, I don't really know anything about Grace Cathedral Church. I've read what is contained in the casework, and I can already tell you that on a personal level, me personally, they give me the heebie-jeebies. Just like that guy at the beginning from Nolens, where he's, you know, he's got to have a $54 million jet because Jesus wouldn't ride no donkey. These people in Akron kind of, they're kind of people that just make me nervous. They really do. They have beliefs about God that I do not share. And having said that, you just need to keep in mind my own personal bias as we go forward from this. I try to weed it out, but I'm not always successful in doing so. Religion is a very touchy subject to me. It really is. Someday, maybe I'll get into it on my own show. I try not to, because all you do when you talk religion is offend people, but like the people at Grace Cathedral who might be listening right now are already offended because they give me the heebie-jeebies. I'm sure I give them the willies too, but you don't see them complaining about that, do you? At any rate, Grace Cathedral hit on an idea. Now, one of the tenets of the Christian faith is the proselytization of other people. They're reaching out to other people. At one point in my career as a pastor, and for those of you who don't know, I was a pastor at one point, I was stationed in a little place called Toccoa, Georgia. Now, Toccoa, Georgia, right on the South Carolina border, is well known as a very religious city. Toccoa Falls College is there, which is a Christian, leading Christian college. It is very... Well, let me put it to you this way. The entire county had, I think, 8,000 people in it. And there were 32 churches within the city limits of the city of Toccoa. Okay, 32. And I used to get letters from my superiors within the faith who would criticize me and complain to me in a roundabout way. Hey, why isn't your Sunday school attendance going up? Why aren't you working on this? And my response to it every time was, dude, there's 32 churches here. Anybody that's not in church on Sunday morning is not in church on Sunday morning because they don't want to be in church on Sunday morning. And me going out and grabbing them and dragging them in against their will really isn't going to help. It's not going to do anything. I'd rather work with the people who are here and make some progress that way, especially considering the fact that we were a holiness church, but that just went right over their heads in most cases. At any rate, this church wanted to proselytize, because that's the tenet of the Christian faith. We have to proselytize. We must reach out. If we're not reaching out, something's wrong with us. And so the pastor hit on an idea. Let us open a cafeteria. The cafeteria will be on our property. We will own it. But it will be open to the public. And we'll make it a really good cafeteria. People will want to come here to eat. And as part of this, obviously we're going to have to hire some staff. And they ended up hiring 35 people, employees, full-time employees, to work at the cafeteria. But in addition to that, they needed more people to make it work. And so the pastor would get up in his pulpit on Sunday mornings right before his sermon, and he would announce how many people they needed to volunteer this week at the cafeteria. The understanding being, of course, that as a volunteer, as an unpaid employee, as an unpaid person, with no expectation of pay, you could proselytize. So while you're spooning up those black-eyed peas or whatever and handing them over to the cafeterias have kind of gone the way of the dodo, haven't they? I used to love going to cafeterias, but they don't exist anymore. Anyway, as you're dishing over the dish there, you can tell people Jesus loves them. And have you heard about, you know, this verse in Hebrews or 1 Timothy or whatever, and we can talk about this and we can reach out with the love of Jesus, who is not riding on a donkey. You with me here so far? So the church sees this as the free exercise of their religion, right? These people are they're volunteered. There is no expectation of being paid. And so things go on. The cafeteria, by the way, is not financially successful. The church ends up subsidizing it. It's not making money. No surprise there. But it does employ 35 people, and it does give the church the opportunity to reach out in the name of their version of God. And by all accounts, they're pretty good at doing this. However, like most volunteer efforts, it takes a lot of work to get the volunteers you need and to get them scheduled right and to get everybody in there and to keep it rolling. It's a full-time job most times keeping a volunteer operation running. It really is. I can tell you that from personal experience. The pastor would make it a fairly regular routine as part of his sermon or before his sermon to encourage people, and I'm using the word encourage somewhat euphemistically, he would encourage people to volunteer by essentially telling them that if they didn't volunteer, they were displeasing God. They were risking their eternal souls by not volunteering at the cafe. Now look, if you're going to go to the church and you're going to believe in the church's mission, kind of stands to follow that you should volunteer to be a part of whatever mission it is, right? You believe in it or you wouldn't be there. Well, that's what most people would think. And so there's a certain guilt level. Hey, you really haven't done your part. There's a certain, you know, encouragement level. Hey, this is a great opportunity to reach out for God. Hey, this is a great what the exact words he used were pretty amusing at times. Let's see. He called it the Lord's Buffet. And if you didn't volunteer, you were, quote, blaspheming against the Holy Ghost, which is an unforgivable sin in their church. Ushers pass around slips of papers. Prisoners interested in volunteering would write down their phone number, hand it in. Then they'd get calls from the pastor himself, sometimes asking them to volunteer. Managers would work very diligently around their schedules. Again, nobody's being forced to do this, although there is a coercion, threat of you know, spiritual damnation if you don't. But really, it's kind of out of the realm of legislation, right? It's between God and man. There you go. At least one parishioner, a gal by the name of Alicia Gay, said that she did not return a phone call. She got a call from the pastor directly who asked her to work. She said she agreed to because she, quote, feared failing God, unquote. Well, it will not surprise you that in 2013, actually in 2012, 2013, the federal government took a little interest in this. And although no one, not a single person involved with this, not a parishioner from the church, not an employee of the buffet, not a customer of the buffet, cafe, complained about anything. But the government found out about it by whatever means that they do. I'm sure it was in the newspapers or whatever. And so they said, wait, you can't force people to work like that. You can't threaten people to work. And so they accused the church of violating the Fair Standard Labor Act or whatever. They said they're not tracking people's time correctly because these people should be paid. You're forcing them to pay. You're coercing them to be paid. And this argument went on for 2 years before the church was finally taken to court in 2014 by the Justice Department and charged with violations of the FSLA. And naturally, as a part of all this, initial injunctions, initial rulings, the cafeteria was shut down by the government. Now you can see already where this is going to go in the courts. Hey, we are freely expressing our religion. We are, as a church, doing that which we believe advances our cause. We are doing the things that we believe God has told us to do. Again, whether I agree with it, whether you agree with it or not, is irrelevant. The Constitution says freely, free exercise thereof. Okay, so off this goes to the courts. And so the courts have to consider, what does it mean to freely exercise the religion? And does Congress have the ability to pass a law, the Fair Standards Federal, what is it, Fair Standard Labor Act, Fair FLSA, Federal Labor, Fair Labor Standards Act, whatever the heck it's called. Can Congress pass that in violation of perhaps religious duties? Boy, does this open a can of worms, doesn't it? Because we've had this argument before, of course. We've had these discussions before. How far can the government go in doing things that will stop the free exercise of a religion? Do we have to let Indians, Native Americans, smoke peyote? Do we have to allow prisoners certain types of food, even at the expense of the taxpayer who's now footing the bill for what they're doing? Do we have to provide books? Do we have to, where is the line in all of this? And oh, by the way, what about the, and I'm going to use a phrase here that's going to piss somebody off, I'm sure, the dingbat religions. What if you have a religion that just has the most inane practice? Okay, we'll just make up one here. Let's just call it, I don't know, the religion of the television remote. What if I'm required to carry this everywhere with me, even onto an airplane, you know, with its batteries and all that stuff? Can the government say to me, you don't need that there? But my faith requires it. We talked about this on Constitution Thursday, the Saturday podcast with Jeff and Pat some years ago. We had the discussion of the juror, the Sikh juror, who wanted to be impaneled on a jury, but was told he couldn't enter the courtroom because he would not take off his karpan, his knife, and weapons were not allowed in the courtroom. Well, is it really a weapon, or is it a religious object that I'm required to carry with me at all times because that is how we express and exercise our faith? It's an article of faith that we carry this. And we had a wonderful discussion about that because I've said this before, I'm fascinated by the Sikh religion. I have no interest in joining it, but I'm fascinated by it because it's so misunderstood. Most of the time, people see a Sikh and they automatically assume Muslim, and they couldn't be more wrong. There's nothing similar whatsoever between Islam and Sikhism. They're diametrically opposed on about everything, but they look similar. And so people go, well, it must be the same. Anyway, we had this whole discussion because at that point, the case hadn't been resolved as to whether or not this gentleman should be allowed to carry the karpan in and be on a jury. For the record, my position was he should have been allowed to. People who want to be on juries are a rare breed, and they're far and few and far between. And so consequently, why would you turn them away when they present and represent absolutely no threat whatsoever? It was very remarkably unlikely that this man was going to, in the middle of the trial, whip out his karpan and, you know, start going to town on people. That wasn't going to happen. And so it was a religious object. It was not, besides which there's an armed deputy there, armed deputy with a gun, Sikh guy with a 4-inch karpan. I know where my money's going to go. At any rate, in the middle of the whole discussion, we never did come to a conclusion because in the middle of all this came the story of the Sikh temple in Sacramento, where for whatever reason, their karpans were bigger, some in the order of 2 and 3 feet long, and the temple there got into a big argument with two different sides. And lo and behold, they whipped out the karpans and started going to town on each other, which I know it's not funny. I know you're not supposed to laugh at things like that, but for the life of me, I can't help it. Just the image of 20 or 30 Sikh guys going at each other with swords in 21st century America. Just, I don't know. For some reason, I find that amusing. I don't apologize for the fact that I find it funny. All in the name of who's right about God, once again brings us back to, well, the court has a problem with, you know, what do we have to allow? What can we not allow? How far do we have to go to either limit or allow the exercise, the free exercise of religion? Should we allow people to carry swords? Maybe not. Should we say to people, yeah, that's a problem. People who want to sacrifice pigs, you know, what if you have a religion that says, I got to go downtown in the middle of the city plaza there on a certain day of the year? I don't know, pick one, May 31st. Daveism. See, this would be Daveism. May 31st is the day that Dave ascended from California to Washington. Maybe we should, you know, sacrifice something at the city hall, because maybe someday, if our sacrifices are expiatory enough, Dave will return to California. And so we'll sacrifice something. It wouldn't be a pig in my case. Maybe a Giants jersey. We have to build a big shrine of Giants jerseys and Giants hats, San Francisco Giants stuff, and we have to burn it, hoping that Dave will come back. Do you think the courts would allow that? Do you think the government would look at that and go, yeah, that's legit? Or would they look at that and go, dude, that's insane? First off, Dave's not coming back. But second off, that's just a bit too much. You know, big old fire in downtown, that would be dangerous. And we kind of frown on that. But crazier religions than that have existed. Witchcraft exists. Satanism exists in the United States. And whatever you think of it, and it doesn't really matter to me, but whatever you think of it, is it not a common belief that those things come with human sacrifice? Should that be allowed as a free exercise? If a Satanist kills someone as a sacrifice, can that legitimately be their plea at trial? Was, hey, free exercise of religion, you can't pass a law about that. Yankee jersey. It could be Yankees, but to get me back in California, it would have to be San Francisco Giants stuff. Anyway, point being that throughout our history, there have been religions that have what some people would believe to be reasonable or legitimate exercises thereof that we've had to make decisions about. Perhaps the most important one, not in the sense of it really matters, but in the sense of arguments between the courts and arguments between people, came about in the 1800s, of course. And no surprise here, it started in a place called, anybody want to guess? Come on, say it with me. That's right, Utah. And it had to do with, anybody? How many women can I marry? How many women can I be married to because it's a free exercise of my religion? You'll notice today that the rule is one. How did we get there? And that's kind of where we're going next. Stay with us. It's Constitution Thursday right here on Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Stay with us. Back right after this.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it. You hear it every time you finish a meal and never feel anything. But if we were able to associate this sound with a new stimulus, save the food, we've achieved pulling a natural response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. Because this ad is trying to change your after-meal behavior through brainwashing. Because food waste costs the average family $1,500 a year. Save the food. Cha-ching. And $1,500 extra bucks is like getting a pay raise. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Which could pay for your child's braces. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Check out my braces.
So when you hear this sound, rethink your behavior. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit SaveTheFood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.
Science Underground with your host, Anissa Ramirez.
This week,
the mysterious number pi and its hidden uses. I'm Anissa Ramirez, and this is
Science Underground.
Apple, blueberry, and 3.14. What do they have in common? They're all forms of pi. You might have heard of this mathematical number called pi, and you might know that it defines a circle by relating the circumference to the diameter. This might not seem like much to you, but circles are everywhere, so that means that pi is too. Not only are circles defined by pi, but also repeating cycles. That means that swinging pendulums for telling time, alternating current for the flow of electricity, and even satellite orbits for GPS all use pi. Besides being everywhere, pi's been around for a long time. There's even a mention of it in the Bible for building round things. However, back then, they used the number 3, but that wasn't exactly right. We know now that that 3 is followed by other numbers after the decimal point. That's one of the strange things about pi. It can't be written as a fraction. Mathematicians would call it irrational. For more on this, Mario Livio, an astronomer and best-selling author, explains.
You cannot write any fraction that will be equal to pi. Sometimes people use 22 over 7 as a number that kind of comes close to pi, and indeed it comes fairly close, but it is definitely not equal to pi.
Pi has some hidden uses too. Whenever you want to take the average of something and need to do statistics, then you're secretly using pi. Say you wanted to measure the heights of kids in a class. If you were to plot the heights of those kids, the shape of the curve would look like a bell. This is called a bell curve, or a normal distribution. The mathematical formula for the bell curve has pi in it. The bell curve doesn't look like a circle, but pi is inside of it. Pi is a mysterious number that touches so many parts of our lives without our knowing. But just like the apple and blueberry versions, the pi of 3.14 is pretty sweet. I'm Anissa Ramirez, and this was
Science Underground.
Tweens have mastered the art of tuning out. Jen, there's a spider in the car. We're turning your room into a home gym. See? Nothing. But some messages need to get through, like making sure they're buckled up the whole ride, every time. Do whatever it takes to make your child listen. Jen, I friended your boyfriend.
Wait, what?
Buckle up, sweetie.
Never give up until they buckle up. Learn more at safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
I'm a retired school psychologist, and helping people was my thing. After my stroke, when Meals on Wheels started, I was on the other end of the stick, so to speak. My name is Julius Gaines, creative writer, poet, photographer.
One in six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at AmericaLetsDoLunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
What's up, Whitey?
Hey, Scotsman.
We're from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening
to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Radio Network.
They're in. Like God's name is just perfect for them.
Well, you see, Ma, that's because you're brought up hearing that name. You're used to that word.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, really? If you were taught that God's name was, let's say, Chair, you'd be calling him Chair.
Get out of here. You can't get people into a church to worship a chair.
Maybe not, but you can get people to work at a cafeteria by telling them that if they don't, God will damn them. Right? I mean, that's kind of the heart of what we're arguing here. The government's argument, by the way, against the cafeteria was that the people were being coerced. They were being forced to work by the threat of eternal damnation. And therefore, they should be paid since they were being forced to work. In the 1870s, the territory of Utah, and the history of Utah would fill the whole, we could do a show on Utah, but the idea was that Utah wanted to be a state, but Utah also wanted to be the state of Deseret, which included Nevada by its definition. As you know, by the 1870s, Nevada had already become a state during the war. Battleborn, 1864, Utah was left. Utah was not trusted because it was unclear what the prevailing state government, led by the LDS Church, really was all about. It just wasn't. They just weren't trusted, and so troops were often left in Utah, and things were there. And one of the issues with the Mormons, one of the issues with the LDS Church, was, of course, the practice of polygamy. Now, again, whether I agree with it, whether you agree with it or not, is irrelevant. The LDS Church of the 1800s believed very firmly that they had a responsibility to God to marry as many women as they could and have as many children as they can. The old joke that, you know, one wife is more than I can handle sometimes, notwithstanding, the church really believed this. And of course, the United States in the 1840s had passed laws doing away with polygamy. Well, I guess that would be bigamy too. They had done away with these laws very strictly for all of the nation. They didn't just focus on Utah. They just didn't go to the Mormons and say, well, this is an anti-Mormon law. There were other people that had done similar things, usually justifying it on the basis of the Bible. So they had passed a law throughout the entire country banning bigamy and polygamy. Now, you can argue why, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but you could argue that it's harmful in many ways, but the Mormons didn't believe that. They believed very firmly that they were doing the right thing. The LDS Church came to believe in the 1870s that the law was unconstitutional. It deprived the members of the First Amendment right to freely practice their religion. And so the church decided they were going to challenge this law in court. And they had a big discussion amongst themselves, not making this up now, and they got somebody to volunteer to be charged under the act, the Anti-Bigamy Act at the time, so that he could be charged, convicted, and appeal all the way up to the Supreme Court if necessary, the conviction on the basis of they were being told they could not freely practice their religion. And of course, he was indicted in 1874. 1875, he was convicted. This guy's name was Reynolds. He was sentenced to 2 years at hard labor and a fine of $500 in 1874 money. And in 1876, the territorial Supreme Court upheld the sentence. Meanwhile, the U.S. attorney for the area, William Carey, understanding what was going on, agreed that while this case was working its way through the courts, he would not charge anyone else with polygamy. He would not arrest anybody else. He would not have anybody else. So there was this kind of agreement between the United States government representative and the LDS Church that, okay, while the court is deciding this, we'll have a truce. But of course, government didn't do that. They didn't keep their words, and Carey started arresting people and LDS Church members, and so the cooperation went out the window. In the decision, the statute reads, every person having a husband or wife living who marries another, whether married or single, in a territory or other place over the United States having exclusive jurisdiction is guilty of bigamy and shall be punished by a fine of not more than $500. Not more than 5 years. During the trial, Mr. Reynolds tried to have the jury instructed that if he found he committed bigamy with the intention of following his religion, he must be found not guilty. Now, this is an interesting point here because now the jury has the opportunity to look at this law and go, free exercise thereof, he's exercising freely. We nullify this law and find him not guilty. But they didn't because, well, frankly, there was probably a good deal of anti-Mormon bias. The court found him guilty. The jury found him guilty. The courts upheld it, and all the way it went to the United States Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court had to consider whether or not Reynolds could use his religious belief or duty as a defense. He had argued that as a Mormon, as an LDS Church member, it was his religious duty as a male member of the church to practice polygamy, if at all possible. I've been to Utah. I grew up in Utah. I'm telling you, it's probably possible. The courts recognize that under the First Amendment, Congress cannot pass a law that prohibits the free exercise of religion. However, they question whether or not bigamy and its law prohibiting that met that standard. In other words, you say that your religion requires you to practice bigamy, but we have a law that says no bigamy. Does the law meet the standard of preventing you from freely exercising your religion? What does free exercise mean? The court noted that all the way back to King James I of England, English law, upon which our laws were pretty much based, bigamy had been outlawed. It had been against the laws of the nation that we had essentially been a part of all the way back as far as we had existed. And of course, then came the Danbury letter. Which, again, we hold most people oversimplify to the simple idea that there's a separation of church and state. You have to keep the two separated. And to his credit, that's what Thomas Jefferson wrote. Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature would, quote, make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, unquote, thus building a wall of separation between the church and state, adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation in behalf of the rights of conscience, I shall see with sincere satisfaction the progress of those sentiments which tend to restore man all his natural rights, convinced that he has no natural right in opposition to his social duties. Well, that's a mouthful, isn't it? That's a whole lot more than just separation of church and state, isn't it? Because even the Danbury letter says very succinctly, the legislative powers of the government reach actions only and not opinions. So the legislature then, the court reasoned, can pass laws that affect actions. No, Dave, you cannot encourage a religion to burn San Francisco Giants jerseys and hats and Los Angeles Angels jerseys and hats in the town square from whence you ascended in hopes that it will somehow or another expiate and propitiate you to come back. You can't do that. See why? Because it's an action, and that action will have consequences. Can you imagine what would happen if some lunatic went down in the city hall of wherever city, piled up a stack of one of the local team's jerseys, and set it on fire because he said his religion told him to? Can you imagine what would happen? I can guarantee you what would happen where I used to live. He'd get his butt kicked. There would be a riot. There would be people screaming. There would be people shouting. There would be people angry. Actions have reactions. Right? The court reasoned that the legislative powers of the government reach actions only, not opinions. I'm free to exercise my religion that I believe that I should be able to marry more than one woman, was Reynolds' argument. But the action of doing so was limited by the law of the land for reasons that are clearly social. Many sociologists would argue with you that it's not good for the woman, even within the concept of bigamy and polygamy. You have a first wife, you have a second wife, you have a third wife, a fourth wife, and the ranking systems, by definition, could be harmful. In the cases where you see it in the Bible, particularly Abraham and his wife, Sarah, and his second wife, it causes problems. It creates social difficulties. And Jefferson had also added in that letter, I want to see man restored to all his natural rights, convinced that he has no natural right in opposition to his social duties. Your natural rights cannot be in opposition to your duties as a citizen, your social duties of those around you. And the court saw bigamy and polygamy in that light. They said, no, sorry, you can believe that you have to do that, but you can't practice that here because it is an action which comes with reactions and it's in violation of your social duty. Do you see what the court is arguing here? Do you see what the court concludes? And so they upheld the anti-bigamy laws, and those laws still to this day are in effect. Now, I don't really understand why, although I was fascinated by the show Big Love. Polygamy and bigamy are apparently making a comeback, and perhaps it's a social change in our country. Nobody seems to care much anymore. We got 3 people marrying each other now and 4 people marrying each other and 3 in a tree and 3 in a bridge or whatever. And nobody seems to, it's still against the law, but nobody seems to care much anymore because of the sociological damage that was being done. And the actions and the reactions to that have changed significantly now, haven't they? Nowadays, people aren't surprised by anything and they don't really seem to care much. But 130 years ago, it was a different world, a different place. And so we come to Sister Wives. That's the other show. My wife watches that. I was fascinated by Big Love, but my wife likes Sister Wives. I don't know why. Anyway, we come back round then, 200 and some odd years after the Danbury letter, to Akron, Ohio, where the court now has to consider whether or not, and this is in the Sixth Circuit Court, where the court has to consider these same things. Is this a free exercise of their religion? And do the laws that Congress has passed affect actions or opinions? Oh, and by the way, were these people coerced? And that's the primary government argument here, is that the people were coerced into doing so. That they were told that if they didn't do it, they were in danger of their immortal souls. Now, I have to be honest with you, and I got to be a little more detailed than I normally would be about these things. I understand that argument. I believe, and this is my own personal belief about my own personal life and experience, I believe that religious leaders often use that threat. I believe that my life went the direction it did because of a similar concept. Dave, God really wants you to do this. Dave, God has called you. Dave, if you don't do this, you're ignoring God. And at a time when I had a different set of beliefs about what God is and what God does, these things appealed to me. And they made it clear to me that if I were to ignore them, that God would somehow or another not, he may not punish me per se, but he certainly would not reward me. And my life would not be as fulfilling or meaningful if I did not follow these things. And what I realize looking back at it is that it's a very manipulative scheme. Sorry if it offends you that I say that. I'm sorry if you're one of those people that does that. If you have a sincere belief of that, that's fine. I'm not saying you are doing that. I'm saying that the people I've come to believe, that the people who talk to me that way, were being highly manipulative to get what they wanted. God didn't have anything to do with it. And it certainly wasn't in my best interest. But maybe like a congregation member sitting there on a Sunday morning in Akron, Ohio at Grace Cathedral, hearing your pastor say, hey, if you don't do this, you are blaspheming the Holy Spirit And that is an unforgivable sin in our congregation. Is that any different from saying, if you don't volunteer at our cafe, you're going to hell? I mean, functionally, there's no difference. And if you're an average congregate, wait. And given the state of Christianity and Christian understanding in our country in this era, people are likely to believe stuff like that. People are likely to go, oh, well, then I guess I should do that. And even there's something about the piling on of it that makes people gather in and go, hey, we should do that. And I say that as someone who gave in to that kind of pressure and gave into that kind of logic and gave into that kind of, well, if you really believe this about God, then how can you not believe what I'm saying? Mentality. And my life took a turn that I deeply regret, that I have come to believe God had no part of whatsoever, didn't intend for, didn't mean to be. And while we all tried to make the best of it, it ended up in a disaster because it couldn't be anything else. But I would also tell you that I wouldn't be where I am if it hadn't happened. And which goes back to what I believe about God, which is that sooner or later, we'll get it all straightened out. At any rate, that's my story. These people were told, do this or else. And so the government's argument before the Sixth Circuit Court is, very simply and very succinctly, these people were forced to do this. They should be paid. They're in violation of the FLSA. And we have shut this thing down because we're doing the best thing for the people of this whatever by forcing, by stopping the free exercise, as they claim, of their religion and the actions thereof. So the Sixth Circuit Court got together and said, okay, what do we do? Where do we look at that? By the way, it's the Fair Labor Standards Act. I don't know where, FLSA. And that law's been around since 1938. The lower trial court agreed with the Department of Labor and said, yeah, these people are in violation. These people are crazy. They didn't say that, but they said these people are in violation of the FLSA. These people should have been paid. And yes, we find them guilty of violating our laws. Sixth Circuit Court, however, did not see it the same way. They sent the case back. Said, you're not considering all the things that you should be considering here. To be considered an employee within the meaning of your law, the FLSA, a worker must expect to receive compensation. And it's very clear here that nobody that volunteered expected to be paid. They expected the opportunity to proselytize, but they did not expect to be compensated. And one of the justices, Judge Raymond Kethledge, took the time to write his own concurrence with this ruling. He concurred, but he also went on to write some other things about this. That the congregation volunteers should count as employees because, quote, their pastor spiritually coerced them to work there. That argument's premise, namely that the Labor Act authorizes the department to regulate the spiritual dialogue between pastor and the congregation, assumes a power whose use would violate the first exercise clause, or sorry, the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. In other words, if we accept your argument here, who are you to say whether or not this is legit? Who is the government to say that God really won't condemn these people? They believe it. It's their religion, and they believe it. And now you're telling them that it's not true. He goes on to note that the record makes clear that the buffet's purpose was to allow church members to proselytize amongst local residents who dined there. Oh, and by the way, the judge says, this is the best part. This place had 35 full-time employees that were paid. 35 jobs all of whom have lost their jobs as a result of this lawsuit. Because you've decided that you can tell them what God really means and what God really says. This all started under the Obama Labor Department. The Trump Labor Department did not undo it, primarily because the new solicitor for the department wasn't confirmed by the Senate. Could have been all avoided if that had happened. So when they start talking to you about how slow the Senate is moving at confirmations, you can see one of the direct results is 35 people are unemployed. And we still don't know whether or not a pastor coercing spiritually people to work is a violation of the free exercise clause or not. But we'll keep an eye on it and see what ends up happening. Something tells me that the church is probably going to win this one. Got to get going. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life. You love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman, and this is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Check out all the great shows we have coming up for you at podcast99.org. Click on the Listen Live Now button, and you can hear Tim Preuss coming up at noon. He's libertarian ranting again. All I'm going to say, it's the war on drugs thing. So you can check that out, as well as podcasts and everything else. The El Evangelist Show, Jay's political pod, This Week in U.S. Politics with Jay, and other shows as well. Have a great rest of your day, everybody, and we will see you tomorrow for a Friday episode of The Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Plausibly Live is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. To contact Dave directly, call or text area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. For more information or to hear past shows, go to www.plausiblylive.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.
You don't need a smug, I told you so from me. And smug it would be, because tell you I most certainly did.